I'm going to tell you a little bit about me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about an author who provokes me. That's Douglas John Hall. I want to talk a little bit about optimism. And I want to talk about that in two ways, as it affects the church and as it affects that which we consider apart from the church, American, or way of life or whatever. I would like to, in part of this discussion, invite your commentary toward the end of it, although tonight at the forum is when we really hope that you will speak out and share those things that you've thought during the day and those reactions you have to what has been said and what has happened. I'm going to talk a little bit about cross theology as it applies to what we talk about before we talk about that. In starting out, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some things that I have done and a few places I have been. And I think some of that can inform the kinds of things we're thinking about when we talk about the book Light in Our Darkness. I remember as a young boy, and that was in the 30s, thinking about what it was I wanted to do with my life, what kind of things you worked for, what kind of expectations, hopes, dreams, those things that you wanted to happen, expected to happen. I thought about the kind of things I would have to do to make those things happen. One of those happened to be in the field of printing. At that time, the Printers Union, the International Typographical Union is what it was called, had an iron hard grip on the printing industry. You could not work in a print shop in 98% of the United States without having a union card that said, you can do this. And I worked to excel, and I produced, and I put my entire energy to doing that in my late teens. In fact, I did that at night when I was in high school so that I'd even have more jump on this kind of thing. And at 19, I became a printer. I was accepted into the Typographical Union. And I remember the men who talked. There were no women in that trade. They were not allowed at that time. And they talked about their security. They talked about their pensions. They talked about bigger shops, better machines, faster ways to do things. They fought for 17 years in one shop. I wasn't there that whole time, but they fought for 17 years with all kinds of human energy to get an air conditioning system. At that time, I think the average wage was $6,000 to $7,000 a year for a tradesman. Printers were making $11,000, $12,000, good money. They were paying good money in dues. They were paying things like $150 a month, all to put into this pension plan, which they would one day then be able to retire. And they used to talk about retirement, and they would say, when I am 45, I'm going to retire, and that's going to be easy street. I'm going to have my pension and truly enjoy life. And they had their big houses, and they had their big boats in that particular part of the country. That was a big thing to have. And to make the story short, before 15 years more had passed, there was no typographical union. There was no trade as I once knew it. Linotype operators were out on the street wondering what to do. Those who could not adjust to the new electronic technology and photo offset kinds of things, those are printers' terms, were dispossessed. And all of the dreams they had were shattered. They were optimistic. I was optimistic. I thought I was set for life. In fact, I was so set for life that I went and did 100 other things in the process. Well, I've got this all in the bag. Well, before 1965, all of that was gone. Things did not turn out the way I expected them to. I probably knew 300 men who fell beside the wayside with that kind of shattered dream. I thought, this is another paragraph, I thought that education would be the answer. And I remember the first school I went into. It was at the University of Minnesota, and I walked through the doors to the registration office and I looked up. And on the door overhead it said, "The truth will make you free." And I thought, my goodness, I remember how that touched me. How I thought, you know, the more I would learn, the more things I could put in my head, the more truths I could conquer, that sounded like fulfillment to me. And it felt like fulfillment to me. And my blood was young and raced, and I thought, my goodness, I did. I spent some numbers of years of my life, even up till I was 39 years old, in search of truth to set me free. And to make that story short, all it did was teach me more about what I don't know. Douglas John Hall talks about optimism. I was very optimistic. I thought the world could be had for the effort. Another paragraph. I grew up in a time when work was probably that thing you did to justify your worth. It was in the Midwest at that time, Minnesota, Wisconsin. I had grown up in farm country, ranch country. I had watched the men work from daylight hours. It was already ingrained in me, but it became more ingrained as I saw people in the printing trade and in the educational field working, effort expended to become free, to become fulfilled, to garner a place and resources with which to live the rest of their days. And I was very optimistic, as they were optimistic, but they found their optimism very often in work. And when one printer that I knew who was dispossessed had spent several months after that closing of the printing industry for him, said to me, "There is nothing worse than not to be needed." And all of his optimisms didn't mean a thing. Work. John Hall talks about work. Another paragraph. Recently, at another service in another place, I was conducting a worship service, and I opened the session up for prayer. It was a group of miscellaneous people come together from a variety of places, and I would share with you two prayers that were said during that time when I invited the congregation to pray and share their prayer requests. One fellow said, "Lord, make our country great again, like it once was." That was one prayer. Another prayer a little bit later was, "Help our country to rule the world rightly." I don't know if the word rightly was used, but it was, "Help our country to rule the world rightly." A couple of things about those two prayers. I talked to one fellow afterwards. I missed the other one. I said, "What do you mean, make our country great again?" And he said, "Well, when I was young, I was so full of hope and so full of optimism. And I fought in World War II, and I fought in the end of World War I, and I said, I'd have given my life for this country because I thought we had the answers for the whole of the world." And I said, "Well, what's happened?" And he says, "Well, it's all gone to pot." And his optimisms were shattered. His hopes were gone. The other prayer, the one that said, "Help us to rule the world rightly," I missed talking to him, and I really wanted to. But he said some things that we can appropriate even if we don't talk to him. One of those things he seemed to say to me was, "Well, we have the answer, don't we? Is that one of the things he would say? The world needs ruling. Is that one of the things he would say? Maybe some other things hidden in there that we could come back to. But those two prayers have stuck in my mind for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I don't know quite what to do with all of them yet, but I think they apply to some of the things we'll talk about. One other short paragraph. I went to the seminary when I was 48 years old. That's about 4 years ago. I was in Columbus, Ohio. During the course of my stay there, I served as a pastoral assistant in a downtown church, right on Interstate 70. And during the course of my stay at Trinity, the doorbell would ring from 7 to 50 times a day and more from people who were on I-70 looking for a dollar, a can of beans, a place to stay, a job. And they weren't all over 80. And they weren't all illiterate. They were educated, many of them. I talked to numbers of them. Some of them had doctor's degrees. I remember one boy who was 32 years old who had a doctor's degree in cold physics. And in the course of his conversation with me, all of his optimisms were shattered. He had worked for years to become the best cold physicist, whatever that is, and there was no place for him. His technology had passed him by. There was no need for what he was doing. His optimisms didn't work. He didn't know what to do. What he did was get on I-70 and start looking for a place to light and a job or something. He had a wife and 3 children in New Jersey. They were just waiting for him to show up again. And he was hoping to find something with which he could justify himself, live. And I think these kinds of experiences said something to me. One of those things that they said was, the poor, those who hurt, those who are broken, those whose optimisms have been shattered, are no longer over there, somewhere else. I remember the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson. Do you remember those years, some of you? Chicken in every pot and 2 cars and 2 TVs, and people were, they were on the build. And I thought that felt good, too. And I was in it, and I was caught up in it. And poor were so far away, and brokenness and shattered expectations were so far away. But I learned in Columbus, Ohio, if I didn't learn it earlier, that they're here. They were on the doorstep of Old Trinity Lutheran Church, and that they are among us at Holden Village, and that they're among us in all of our places. Those are just some paragraphs in way of beginning, because I think some of my places I've been and things I've done have spoken to some of what comes at me and comes to me and arises from the writings of Douglas John Hall. One of the things I would like to do today is to encourage some interest that you might want to read John Hall. My first book, an encounter with him, was Light in Our Darkness. I'll come back to that in a minute. But he's written 2 other books, and I think just the titles alone say something about who John Hall is. I met John Hall in Columbus, had good visits with him, found him to be a powerful, strong, provocative, wise man. He is a professor of theology in Montreal. Has written book, Has the Church a Future? The title does something to me. It means that there's a question about the church. Go back to Ohio. I preached in 41 different churches in the period of my stay at the seminary. All of them nearly empty. The church in Ohio had lost 17,000 members 1 year, 23,500 the year before. I saw that, and I wondered why, and I don't have all the answers. But when you find a book that says, Has the Church a Future, those things come together and start boiling inside me. I like two things that he says on the back cover of the book. These are his words. The church as we have known it, in short, Christendom, has come to an end. That's strong stuff. It reminded me of all my expectations as a youth. It seemed to be similar, that my optimisms, my hopes, were done. And then he says, this book, he says, has the church a future as a book, shows how tomorrow's church will find a vital future. I mean, he's one of the most hopeful people I know who writes about these kinds of issues. Will find a vital future when it accepts its minority position. In other words, he says, it is not the first question that we conquer the world for Christ, but that we accept our minority position, learn to suffer. I think that's a clue. And demonstrates its faith by a new understanding of the sacraments, preaching, ministry, worship, and servanthood in the world. I hope that little bit invites you to read that book. I've read it 3 times, and I'm still just discovering in it. Here's another book with a title that just boils inside me that he wrote. This is, I think, is his first book, written in 1975 or 74, somewhere in there. The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches. And I think that's probably enough said. It says that there is something to talk about, doesn't it? Light in Our Darkness also says something, just by its very title. It means there is some darkness, right? Or that he sees darkness. It also says light in our darkness. And I think that's important. I remember preaching a sermon once in a town in Ohio, and I talked about things like that. I talked about the American way of life has come to an end. I said, had things like that in there. And boy, did I get it. I didn't know how to respond to all the things I got. But what do I mean? Lord, make our country great again like it once was. This old gentleman praying. Lighten our darkness. And here's a fellow who didn't even realize there was anything wrong. Well, I began to find out why. He was the head of an advertising agency. He was writing the stuff that comes at you on television. And he didn't have a worry in the world as of that day. For his future. And then I began to ponder, as I prepared this little time together with you, what I would call this. And I guess I thought it would be important to call it Darken Our Lightness. And if I have the chance in my days ahead in ministry, wherever that is, I guess I would like to do a session or a talk or a series of presentations on Darken Our Lightness, because I think that still has to happen. I firmly believe that in the experiences of my own life and in the associations with people and men and women of the professions that I've been a part of, I have seen that the American way of life has been stopped, that the American dream isn't quite ringing true anymore, that the optimism that so many people have shared through the years after World War II particularly doesn't quite cut it. I think the new poor on I-70 tell us that. I think those on fixed incomes who don't know how they're going to make it from next week to the next with the escalating prices. I talked to a person like that in just a couple of days ago. Scared to death about what they're going to eat in a year here in America, in a suburb, in a split-level house. Okay. Things are not turning out the way we've expected. I'd like to highlight a few things that I find in John Hall's book. Truth did not set me free. I think discovering this whole book has not set me free. I think my major frustration in meeting with you this afternoon is I can't begin to share with you all of the things that I would like to share with you. But things have not turned out right. And I think recognizing that is the first clue. And I think John Hall does that. I think he finds a way to get at our willingness to admit that we have failed. But how many of you find that easy to do? Do you find it easy to say, I've failed? Do you find it easy to say, all the things I've trusted in don't ring true, and I'm willing to admit that? What is it about humans? What is it about us people that makes us unwilling to admit that? I'm going to share a few lines with you out of the tail end of this book, because I like his title. In fact, I could read you the titles of the chapters of this book, and we could comment about those. But the tail end, the very last thing he says in the book, has a title. It says, The Courage to Have Failed. Expectations and Experience. Do you remember my expectations and my optimisms and my hopes? The experience did not bear them out. John Hall says that human life is a dialogue, conversation, interaction, participation. It's a dialogue between expectations, that which we think will happen, that which we work to happen, that which we see in the future. A dialogue between expectation and experience. And then he talks about conflict and contradiction, and I think these are important. Civilization fails, flounders, falls apart, not when the two elements are in conflict, because he says conflict is the essence of the conversation, but when they no longer have anything to do with each other, when one doesn't inform the other. Did you remember the title of this book? The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches. The conversation has stopped. That's not conflict, that's contradiction. And that's what he's talking about. When the contradiction is so great that they proceed on separate lines, expectation and experience didn't come together. There was no meeting. The conversation stopped. He goes on in one of his chapters about the, first of all, he talks about the officially optimistic society, which is a lot of powerful things, and we'll come back to that. But he talks about the official optimistic religion kind of things, that our churches have gone these two separate ways, that our life, that our gospel does not inform the rest of our life. Contradiction. Let me go back over that just quickly. Life is a dialogue between expectation and experience, and it fails not when those two elements are in conflict, because conflict and conversation is essential, but when they no longer inform each other, our politics and our gospel, when the contradiction is so great that they proceed on separate lines. He believes that human life depends on the healthy dialogue of all of that which we are a part of. He says, our expectations as a civilization have failed. They certainly had for me. We have not been able to sustain the dream called America. We have floundered. And we, of all people, are least capable of facing failure. How's that strike you? He goes on. The courage to have failed is what he's talking about. It's kind of a summary of the major themes of the book. The complicating thing is that of all peoples on the earth, we, in Americans he's speaking of, and he speaks of North Americans because he's Canadian, are the least capable of facing failure. We're locked into the mindset of modernity, progress, the work ethic, the optimism that we can take charge of the life of nature that we have been placed in. Until we have permitted ourselves to admit the failure of old expectations, we cannot be open to new ones. That's darken our lightness, I think. At the same time, the importance of living through this experience at the conscious level and feeling the failure of our dreams and understanding and seeking to know the meaning of the failure is important. What is America? What is this new world, this great society, this bigger, better, a good thing for everybody? But the dream that people can produce the perfect kingdom within the terms of our own mastery. That's sin, basically, isn't it? The way we understand sin. Misuse of the dominion given to us in the first chapters of Genesis. And the world is still full of people who dream this dream. And it's a dangerous dream, he says. If it's not criticized, it can spell the human race, the end of the human race. There's many more things in there. He goes on to talk about the fact that Christianity, and I'm sure, John, if you were there this morning, talked about the theology of glory and the theology of the cross. I'm sure that you probably have seen plenty of that out there. If you turn on your television set any Sunday morning, you can hear the idolatry of Schuller and a variety of others who say, as John Hall cautions against, that failures can be handled by education, business, technology, and the institutions of our society and precisely turned into successes. He goes on to say, nobody ever told us what to do in case of failure, least of all our religion. The unreality of the churches, the reality of the gospel, all of his books and their titles speak to the honesty, to the encouragement for reestablishing this dialogue. Well, I could pick all kinds of plums out of there, but I want to move on because I want to have time for you to talk. Talk about optimism. I've said some things about my own life. Do you know of things that ring true to you? Can you see one of John Hall's major themes, if you were to take an organizing leitmotif, a thematic kind of organizational thinking that goes along in the course of this whole book, it would be like drawing two arrows at each other. One of them would be the American way of life, optimism, and the gospel message on a head-to-head collision course. Can you see things like that? Do those ring true to you? Do you think like that old gentleman who said to me, our country isn't what it once was. Lord, make it great again, like it once was. What kinds of optimistic things don't make sense to you? Is progress certain anymore for you? Does it inevitably get more? Do we master the mysteries of nature? Are we capable of understanding mystery anymore? Is that part of the repertory of our ability to think? Can we be that uncertain, this call to follow me, this folly of this crazy king? There's several hands up. Go ahead, I'll stop for a minute. I can keep on going here. Hall is calling for a calling of the darkness what it is. He's saying, let's look at that. Then he is saying, let's enter into that darkness. Let's not be afraid to admit failure. And then be reborn, find new hope, and keep coming back to this on a daily. He's talking about a way of life, not a whole progression of history. I don't think that we can say, he's saying that our optimisms haven't been what they might be. But we've been so caught in those optimisms that we tend to think that way habitually. And he's calling those illusions. And he's saying, let's take darkness, call it by name, enter into it. But that's a continuing process. And whether that leads us back to something or to something new, it's part of a... Go ahead.
No, I'm just continuing your thought.
It's entering into a daily covenantal thing, realizing that there are some things that are problematic in our time, as there have been in every time. Look at the population of the world. Look at the phenomena of the third, fourth, fifth world. What does that say to us? I said earlier that our American way of life has been stopped. I think I found that in my own life. I think that I saw that in I-70 in Columbus, Ohio. The poor were not over there anymore. There were those who were living the poverty life, not because they chose to live simply, but because there was nothing else they could do. They were out of it. And these things speak to a time in which we live. Those are the kinds of things. The rape of the earth. I grew up on farms and ranches. And the fellows that I talk to in the village who are in farming and ranching tell me that they don't see how their children can farm their land for their lifetime and have any land left to farm because they're screwing it up with chemicals. Some of these things inform these optimisms and will become part of these shattered dreams. Paul is saying, let's call these darknesses what they are and find a way for the church to appropriate the gospel, enter into that darkness, and speak to the reality of a real world. And a daily thing, and it's not going back to an old way, because that's just as foolish as looking ahead to a foolish expectation. It's to recognize the failures of the past, perhaps, and to grow from those. But it's this daily reformation, and all of these other things are in formation for reformation, that reestablish that dialogue, that conversation between expectation and experience, between the gospel and what we do, all the rest of our life, so that they are one process, one life to be lived, one energy expended. Okay, I'll stop. There's hands all over.
What might fit in here and help us, and that's the word pride.
This reads like a paperback, very provocative. This I've read 7-8 times. I had it as a course in the seminary. I've done sessions out of it in other places. I just don't feel I've begun to get it all. And as I sat on the dock waiting to come over here now, I said, I think I'm ready to start putting this session together. You know, it's deep, it's provocative. You get into all of the thinkers of the past who have shaped the Enlightenment. You get into Kierkegaard and he's well read. It's supported. This I found fun.
That'd be a good place to start, maybe.
I thought these two books would be the place I would start, but this is the one that gives me the most satisfaction for having worked. Twice last night, during the night, I read the chapter on optimism, and my head isn't big enough. It really provokes. And I started this book 4 summers ago here at the village. So this really made me call into question that which I've often thought of, having worked in the church for 28 years.
What is the title of that one?
Has the Church a Future? It's one more manifestation of the gospel and being separated from our reality of our life. What do you see as the theology of the cross, as you understand it, saying to what we've talked about? Well, let me read one or two things from John Hall about that particular question. To confess the wisdom of the cross, to confess theologia crucis, that's theology of cross, means to know oneself devoid of wisdom. And I went through those doors thinking all the wisdom in the world. It means being a beggar where understanding is concerned. It condemns every pretension to possession. It takes away all that we use to cover up our essential nakedness. It reduces us to status of beggar, robbed, beaten, and naked at the side of the road. And then he says, only a beggar can receive the gift of grace. You know who he's quoting from here? Martin Luther. Moreover, we must become beggars again and again And again, our natural tendencies are to regard ourselves as self-sufficient, autonomous, masters. We can conquer, we can learn, we can grow, we can enter the union, we can get there, we can have our dream, and so on. And then he says, especially the person of faith, especially this person falls into this habit.
Mm-hmm.
We turn faith into the stuff that will elevate us above the beggarly condition. We regard ourselves as growing progressively beyond, upward from our beggarly condition. And finally, at the end, Luther said, which John Hall quotes, we are nothing but beggars. He was, well, I don't want to really get into what Luther was doing. We got 1 minute left, but yeah, that's true. Does anyone want to offer one last thought? Is this helpful for you? Or is it
problem?
Is it totally distasteful, or wish I wouldn't have said any of this? Or we always have a promise. Our hope is in Him. And John Hall, as I said earlier several times, is one of the hopeful people I read. But you find that hope by calling darkness what it is, entering into it, and dying every day.